Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our sponsors and friends, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. For a book called Names, Sefer Shemot seems to be sorely lacking in them. When we're first introduced to Moshe, the Torah seems to go out of its way to keep everyone involved anonymous. Here is how the Torah first describes Moshe's parents. In the beginning of the second chapter of Sefer Shemot, it says, Vayelech ish mi beis Levi, vayikach es bas Levi. A member of the house of Levi went and took as his wife a woman of Levi. The names of Moshe's parents, Sefer Shmos, the Book of Names, does not say a word. Even earlier, when Moshe's midwives are introduced, the Torah does not introduce them by their real names. Instead, they're called Shifra and Pua. Rashi, of course, is the one who identifies the real names of these midwives. It's Yocheved and Miriam, Moshe's respective mother and sister. Again, the Book of Names, and we are left nameless. Why is the Torah's recounting of the birth of Moshe, the most important Jew in all of Jewish history, missing the names of all those involved? And why does the Book of Names, Sefer Shemos, begin without names? To understand all of this, let's explore how the actual portrait of Moshe has been depicted throughout the ages. The first portrait we have to talk about, and this might be a great reason to plug, because I plug it way too often, our Substack, because we have the actual pictures that we'll be referencing. But the first portrait we need to talk about, of course, is Michelangelo's Moses. In 1505, Pope Julius II commissioned Michelangelo to build his tomb. It took Michelangelo 40 years to complete. This was decades after Julius II's actual 1512 death. He only completed it in 1545. The finished product has become iconic. It's nearly 8 feet tall, and at the center of the tomb is a sculpture of Moses, Moshe. The sculpture is captivating, as Rabbi Benjamin Blech and Roy Dolner explain in their absolutely captivating, it's like Da Vinci Code, but in real life. They have this wonderful book called The Sistine Secrets, Michelangelo's Forbidden Messages in the Heart of the Vatican. Most of the book is about the Sistine Chapel, but a great deal of it discusses some of Michelangelo's other works, including his sculpture of Moses. Michelangelo deliberately spaced Moshe's eyes too far apart, a technique he also used in his sculpture of David. He made the eyes slightly too far apart, extra deep, and not focused on the viewer, they explain. As you stare at the Moses statue today, no matter where you stand, you realize that he is not looking at you, they write. That's because his gaze is fixed firmly on the future. They were not the only people to be captivated by Michelangelo's Moses. In 1914, Sigmund Freud published an essay entitled The Moses of Michelangelo. He had visited the statue a little bit more than a decade earlier for the first time, and he kept on going back. He was captivated by this, and he ended up writing an article analyzing the sculpture. Freud admits that he's not a professional art critic, yet something about the sculpture, or more likely something about Moses himself, about the figure of Moshe Rabbeinu, captivated Sigmund Freud. Freud offers a fascinating thesis. Michelangelo did not depict the Moses of the Bible, but rather an alternative history of Moses where he does not end up breaking the luchos upon seeing the Jewish people worshiping the golden calf. This is what Freud writes. What we see before us is not the inception of a violent action, but the remains of a movement that has already taken place. In his first transport of fury, Moses desired to act, to spring up and take vengeance and forget the tablets, but he has overcome the temptation and he will now remain seated and still in his frozen wrath and in his pain mingled with contempt. Nor will he throw away the tablets so that they will break on the stone, for it is on their special account that he has controlled his anger. It was to preserve them that he kept his passion in check. In giving way to his rage and indignation, he had to neglect the tablets, and the hand which upheld them was withdrawn. They began to slide down and were in danger of being broken. This brought him to himself. He remembered his mission and for its sake renounced an indulgence of his feelings. His hand returned and saved the unsupported tablets before they had actually fallen to the ground. In this attitude, attitude, he remained immobilized, and in this attitude, Michelangelo has portrayed him as the guardian of the tomb. His essay actually includes drawings to highlight how Michelangelo could have depicted Moses, either more serene or more agitated, but clearly chose not to. He depicts a Moshe that does not actually exist in the Torah. According to Freud, Moses' Michelangelo is the Moses that decides not to break the Luchos. This is, of course, not the story depicted in the Bible. In the 34th chapter of Sefer Shemos in Parshas Kisisa, Moshe does break the Luchos. Freud acknowledges that his interpretation departs from Scripture. Again, this is Freud's words. But here it will be objected that, after all, this is not the Moses of the Bible, for that Moses did actually fall into a fit of rage and did throw away the tablets and break them. This Moses must be a quite different man, a new Moses of the artist's conception, so that Michelangelo must have had the presumption to amend the sacred text and to falsify the character of that holy man. Freud's interpretation of Michelangelo tells us more about Freud than it does about Michelangelo, to say nothing of Moses, and even less so the actual Moshe Rabbeinu, the figure we read in the Torah. Freud was nearly obsessed with the personality of Moshe. He returned to him in his final published work before his death, the work called Moses and Monotheism. As Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, the famed historian, discusses at length in his book, Freud's Moses, Judaism Terminable and Interminable, of which we've mentioned it before, and we will definitely return to it again because it's that fascinating. Freud saw his father in Moses, and as he aged, he began to look like his father and saw himself in Moshe's image as well. Reportedly, when Michelangelo finished the sculpture, it was so captivatingly real, the artist grabbed it by the shoulders, and Michelangelo said to his sculptor, "Speak, damn it, speak. Darn it," depending what your sensitivities are, but I think the original does not say darn, but I'll repeat it both ways, both Lashonos. One enduring issue many have raised in reaction to Michelangelo's Moses, that's probably why it's most famous within the Jewish community, is the presence of horns on the head of Moses. Are the horns residual anti-Semitism depicting Jews as demonic, or maybe a poor translation of the word Keren, which is used to describe Moshe and Parshas Kisisa, Keren or Panav, I believe, or something else entirely? So at the end of the 4th century, Saint Jerome translated the entire Bible into Latin, a translation that's now known as the Vulgate. The most obvious explanation for Michelangelo's horns on his Moses is a poor translation of the Hebrew word Keren that appears in the Vulgate. As Professor Stephen Burtman argues in his article, The Anti-Semitic Origins of Michelangelo's Horns Moses, this was not just an error in translation. Rather than representing an innocent mistake, as many have claimed, Burtman writes, the horns of Michelangelo's Moses actually symbolize and serve to perpetuate a legacy of anti-Semitism that stretched from antiquity to the Renaissance. Not everyone sees such nefarious motives behind Michelangelo's horns. The Moses in the tombs was not the original plan. Originally, Moses was supposed to adorn the tomb of Julius II from a much higher ground, and there were supposed to be many, many more sculptures there. Michelangelo's original plan had to be reworked, as it was far too expensive and impractical. And as Rabbi Blech and Dolner argue in their book, Michelangelo created horns for Moses in the hopes that from the elevated perch of the sculpture, it was high up above the ground, the horns would be invisible and just refract light, creating the illusion of light emanating from his head, exactly as described in the Bible. Michelangelo was hardly anti-Semitic, as they argue throughout the book. In fact, his art portrays much more of an anti-church bias. Instead, they explain, the artist had planned Moses as a masterpiece, not only of sculpture, but also of special optical effects worthy of any Hollywood movie. Which brings us to the second portrait of Moshe that I'd like to discuss, and that is Rembrandt's Moses. Just after a century after Michelangelo completed his sculpture, Rembrandt completed his work, Moses Breaking the Tablets of the Law, in 1659. He did not repeat Michelangelo's controversial decision to depict Moshe with actual horns. Instead, in his portrait, Moses' face is seen glowing. Additionally, Moses is holding two tablets, consistent with the biblical description, the Hebrew words on the luchos are both legible and generally correct. Rembrandt's fealty within his paintings to biblical and more notably rabbinic accuracy is no doubt attributable to his warm relationship to the Jews of Amsterdam, most notably a figure that we just recently discussed, Menashe ben Yisroel. As Stephen Nadler masterfully argues in his work Rembrandt's Jews, which again was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, that's a must-read book, the artist relied upon his relationship with Menashe ben Yisroel to accurately portray biblical scenes as interpreted through rabbinic literature. Perhaps the most notable example of Rembrandt's work incorporating rabbinic interpretation is Belshazzar's Feast, which depicts the scene in the fifth chapter of Daniel through the rabbinic interpretation offered in the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Chaf Beis Amud Aleph on 22a. You can look that up over there, but the portrait is clearly, there's no way he could have done Belshazzar's Feast without knowing how the Gemara in Sanhedrin on Chaf Beis Amud Aleph interprets the psukim that it's based upon in the fifth parak of Daniel. As Stephen Nadler writes, whatever the circumstances of their initial meeting, what probably brought the two men together in the end was need. Rembrandt's need. He wanted to get the details right. And Menashe, perhaps more than anybody, with his easy ability to explain matters Jewish to non-Jews and with his knowledge of rabbinic literature, mysticism, and messianism, could help him write down to the serif of the Aleph. He's pointing out that the Hebrew fonts in Rembrandt's pictures are extraordinarily accurate. As Sholem Sabar writes in his article Between Calvinists and Jews, Hebrew Script in Rembrandt's Art, the artist's interaction was a glimpse into a more peaceful coexistence and mutual enlightenment that at times modernity brought between Jews and non-Jews. At best, it allowed for a better knowledge of the other, Sabar writes, closer interaction and an exchange of ideas, all of which reflects a rather improved and tolerant approach to Jews and Judaism. Menashe ben Yisrael, who hoped to bring a messianic reconciliation through his work, looked at these forms of collaboration as a glimpse towards a Christian reevaluation of their relationship to the Jewish people. As he writes in his work Mikveh Yisroel, so at this day we see many Christians desirous to learn the Hebrew tongue of our men. Hence, may be seen that God has not left us, for if one persecutes us, another receives us civilly and courteously. Which brings us to our third portrait of Moshe, and that is Rav Yisrael Lifshitz's Moses. Controversies around depictions of Moshe were not limited to Gentile portraits. A different storm brewed around the image of Moshe, but this time the source was not a painting, but a legend repeated in a rabbinic commentary on the Mishnah. In Rav Yisrael Lifshitz's masterful commentary on the Mishnah, it's a Mishnah at the end of Kiddushin, Tov Sheberofen LeGehenim, the best of doctors go to hell, the Tiferes Yisrael quotes the following legend. This is a classic commentary on the Mishnah, and he cites the following legend. After Moshe redeemed the Jewish people from Egypt, an Arabian king sent an artist to paint Moshe's portrait. When the Arabian king received the portrait, he asked one of his advisors, who was an expert in analyzing an individual's characteristics based on the facial patterns, to look at the portrait of Moshe. I think that art of analyzing pictures to figure out people's character is called physiognomy. I don't really know how to pronounce it, but there's a fancy word for it. The report of this expert was very unflattering. Moshe, the expert explained, possessed terrible personal traits. He was greedy, arrogant, and unkind. The Arabian king was shocked. He thought something must have been wrong with the portrait. So he set out to meet Moshe himself. When he met Moshe, he saw the portrait was correct. How could this be? Moshe himself explained, according to this legend, that he did indeed possess these unseemly natural characteristics, but through his self-discipline and self-development, he managed to overcome them. As Professor Schneer Lyman explains in his classic treatment of this legend, which is printed in Tradition, you can find it on Professor Lyman's website, the Lyman Library, and the article is called Rabbi Israel Lipschitz, The Portrait of Moses. This commentary created quite a controversy. Broadsides decried the disrespect this legend displayed for our teacher, Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbeinu. Rav Elio David Rabinowitz Teumim, the father-in-law of Rav Kook, said it was poor judgment to include this story, which he asserts must have come from pagan myths. Rav Kook also has a letter where he disagrees with this story. His critics were not wrong. As Professor Saul Lieberman has shown, the legend actually originates from the Greco-Roman period, but it was not originally about Moshe. The original version was about Socrates. The Tiferes Yisrael, while a classic commentary on the Mishnah, it's printed in this classic, you could find in every base medrash, did not escape controversy. This is actually not mentioned by Schneer Lyman, but I found it absolutely fascinating. In a responsa of the Munkacher Rebbe, which is actually dealing with a fascinating question, I'll say it over here, you could look it up yourself. It's in Shaul and Tshuva's Minchas Elazar, Simon Samach Dalad, number 64. He's asked the question of what is the halacha, how does Jewish law decide if somebody sends somebody as a shliach to eat food without a bracha? A shliach to eat food, you send somebody as your shliach to eat food without a bracha. What is the halacha? You could look that up over there or think about it yourself. Would that be an exception to the normal rule we have of ein shliach l'dvar avera? That's a little throwaway. Don't let that distract you. But in that responsa, he references the commentary of Tiferes Yisroel, and he writes, it's like a throwaway, it's wild. He says, Ve'ein ha-sefer Tiferes Yisroel al Mishnayis tachas yadi. I don't have the sefer in my home right now. Why ki husar me batenu be'esha ra'inu? I removed all copies from my house after I saw one of his other commentaries from the end of Nezikin, and you can look that up over there, where he talks about the creation of the world and evolution. There's a lot of really interesting stuff that he talks in there about finding the woolly mammoths. There's a lot of fascinating stuff in there, but he says, I threw all the copies of it out of my house after I saw some of these more iconoclastic theological ideas in the work. They're all gone from his home. He even suggests in this comment that his son, the son of the Tiferes Yisroel, may have added in forged commentaries. We do not know what the face of Moshe actually looked like, but the attempts throughout the centuries to depict his likeness have garnered a great deal of controversy. Ultimately, the search for Moshe's portrait has yielded a portrait of the relationship between art, legend, and the Jewish community through the ages, which brings us back to our parsha. Moshe's parents and midwives are all introduced anonymously. This explains the Maharal, and that Maharal is on the pasuk that introduces Shifra and Pua in the first perek of Shemos, the 15th pasuk. I believe you could look that up over here. The Maharal says this is not an accident. Moshe represents a transcendent redemption that is beyond any specific upbringing, parents, or delivery. He was the destined redeemer of the Jewish people. His parents' names are absent to emphasize that the redemption he represents transcends his specific parents or delivery. And Moshe, in a larger sense, represents the transformation of every Jew throughout Sefer Shemos. The Book of Names begins nameless. Within the exile of Mitzrayim, we are but cogs in a larger machine, products of an enslaved system that obscures our individual purpose. Moshe, the redeemer of the Jewish people and each of us, rises above this form of subjugation and reminds the Jewish people to rediscover our individual names and purpose. Through Moshe's name and portrait, we are given the strength to discover our own. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com, especially this week where you get to see all the images of the portraits and the drawings that appear in Freud's article. It's really fascinating. Thank you again to our sponsors, Janet and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you all so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.